Moreno Ramos is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Moreno Ramos to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, filling in for Ray Hill, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan. The Execution Watch for Robert Moreno Ramos begins.
Good evening, and welcome to the Wednesday, November the 14th, 2018 edition of Execution Watch. Whether you're listening live or on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue, filling in for Ray Hill. Now, as many of you know, Ray is currently in hospice. We wish him a speedy recovery and look forward to his return in a little later on for the next scheduled execution. We will have an update on his condition a little later in the show. If you are tuning in for Arab Voices, usually heard here every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. And please join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Tonight, we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Robert Moreno Ramos. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas and Paige Yannick. Welcome. Now, this program is the first and only live electronic vigil where we provide firsthand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We do appreciate those of you who are joining us internationally and on the World Wide Web. And we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and in front of the death house in Huntsville. Our reporter, Linda Huhan, joins us now live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville. Linda, could you please describe the scene for us?
It's very somber. We have the Mexican consulate out here. They're very anxious to hear what's going to happen. Everything is pending in the Supreme Court. They have not come back with an answer yet. There are several cases out there. And it's just very somber right now because they're hoping that they come down with something that says that he will get a stay. There's probably about 15 people out here that are protesting. No one has come out to cross the line yet to go into the chamber. So there's still hope. His attorney, Dana Lynn Reeser, is back in Houston continuing to file. So we don't know, you know, what's happening yet. We've got our computers open to the Supreme Court just waiting.
Now, Linda, tell us something. Now, we have heard from no word from the Supreme Court, but you say there may still be hope?
Yes, there is still hope.
And who's going to be standing witness tonight? Do you know?
As far as we know, there's no one but the chaplain, and maybe one member from the consulate, but we're not sure because the head of the consulate is out here with us, and some of his people are out here with us, but they have not told us that there's anyone in there. So I don't know.
What about the crowd? Is there any crowd there with you waiting in front of the death house?
Yes, there's like 15 people.
And of course, now we know that there is one live son of Mr. Ramos. Is he going to be one of the witnesses?
I don't think so, but let me ask the consulate because they would probably know. Let me ask him.
We are talking, of course, okay, with Linda Hujan. Linda, what did the consulate say?
Is his son here with him? Is his son with him? Is his son here to witness? No, he's not. No, he's not here.
Linda, can you ask the consulate if there is any legal action on their part to try and have a stay?
Is there any legal action on y'all's part? No.
No last minute moments.
No.
All right. Well, Linda.
No. No. Okay. And there's no legal action on their part. No.
All right, Linda. Well, we're going to continue on with the show. Would you please contact us when you see something happening?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. We've been speaking with our witness in front of the death house in Huntsville, Linda Hujan. Now, let's go to Paige Yannick for an analysis of this case. Paige, how do we get here?
Well, actually, Larry is the chief analyst on this case.
That would have been a nice thing to have told me earlier. Larry, let's go.
Okay, Marlo. We're here because a capital murder purported has been committed. Robert Moreno Reyes, Ramos, was convicted of murdering his wife and his two children. It was the facts are pretty horrendous, but you know, pretty much any murder has horrendous facts. But because there were multiple killings at the same episode, then this makes him death eligible. And the state has tremendous discretion in determining whether it wants to seek the death penalty or not. And this is one where, and when they decide to seek the death penalty, there's a pretty good chance that they can get it. Didn't have to. Probably could have worked something out, but they sought the death penalty, and then once they do that, they fight tooth and nail to make sure they keep it. In this case, Ramos, the facts, and I'll dispense with them as quickly as I can.
But tell me which county he was prosecuted in, please.
This was in
Hidalgo County.
Okay, so okay. South Texas.
Down in South Texas, down in the valley. And I think he was born in Mexico. He's a Mexican citizen. He purportedly, according to the trial testimony, started dating a woman while he was married and had two children. And I think the third child was an older child, whether it's the same wife or not, I'm not sure. And he reportedly told her that he was living with a widow and her two children. And then this happened in November 91, February 92, trial testimony reflects that some of the neighbors heard a fight going on inside the house, vulgar language. And some pretty violent activity going on inside the house. That's February 7. February 10, Ramos, the cousins came by trying to find out where the wife and the family was. And he gave all kinds of different stories there in Mexico. There are different places. Then he married the other woman. Shortly thereafter, the family started asking questions. Where are they? And he gave all kinds of inconsistent statements. Later on, the police get involved based on the family calling about their loved one being missing. And they searched the house. The children's clothing was still there, hid in the attic. And Then, as a result of the search, they found blood smatterings and so forth, splatters inside the house. And so they ended up getting a further search and found that the bludgeoned bodies of the wife and children had been buried underneath a bathroom floor, and he concrete and tiled over that. So he was, but again, it was a horrendous murder, as the old murders are. they sought the death penalty on him. He was convicted. There was an issue at the trial. The thing about a capital murder, there are just a few things that need to be determined. In every case, every criminal case is broken up into two parts: guilt, innocence, and then punishment. The evidence of his guilt was overwhelming, but after guilt is, what do you do with him? And so what the state provides is, on punishment, is primarily evidence of future dangerousness, and the defense seeks to provide evidence of mitigation. And I think Paige, you want to talk about punishment right now? We'll go back and forth, but Paige is going to talk about punishment for a while, and we'll just continue to go back and forth on this.
Well, the punishment hearing was all but abbreviated. It was very, very conclusory. There was no mitigation evidence presented. There was some, to the largest extent, the greatest evidence presented at punishment stage was future dangerousness. And they referred back to the issues that were raised in guilt and innocence in that time period from February 7th until the bodies were discovered on April 7th. And his inconsistent behavior, his differing stories to differing people about his activities, his past history of violence with his oldest child, who testified at punishment, that all fed into there being really no issue at punishment for the jury about whether or not they thought he constituted a future danger to society. There was no issues presented about mental illness. There were no issues presented about any other matter that might have fed into the mitigation argument. I saw nothing in any of the reports I read about mitigation. Everything involved future dangerousness in the punishment hearing, and thus the jury was left with the relatively simple issue as to whether or not there was mitigation. No, there was none. And did his behavior constitute a future danger to society? And they all agreed that, yes, of course it did, based upon the evidence presented at the trial court. It was a relatively uncomplicated punishment hearing, aside from the poignant issue of Mr. Ramos's oldest son, who testified.
And another thing, Marlo, at the punishment phase in any trial in Texas, the state can bring up even unadjudicated alleged offenses, and the judge can decide whether he's going to let it in or not. There was a claim at punishment that he killed a wife in Mexico. Okay. That comes in. And so you have all this punishment evidence, and the thought is that where the real action is. Now the thing is, if this case were tried today with all of the broadcasts and information going out saying if you try a capital murder case, you better go in loaded for bear,
right,
with mitigation evidence. It appears that his trial lawyer did not investigate mitigation.
Was he a public defender?
He was appointed,
okay.
I believe. Clearly he was appointed. But the thing about the law is that the law loves finality. When you've got your shot, you've got your shot. But it appears that his lawyer did not present evidence of mitigation, which was did not investigate mitigation, and did not. So if he didn't investigate it, he could not have presented it. And it is later on it was determined that there was a great deal of evidence on mitigation that was discovered later, in that it was discovered that Moreno Ramos experienced extreme poverty growing up, unrelenting emotional and physical abuse, amounting to torture. He suffered from the beginning of, he was beaten from the age four. Now, and when you look at what his son testified about, the son seemed to be, the son's testimony was consistent with intergenerational abuse. Okay, the son was acting out, he was treating his son pretty much the way he'd been treated. He also had bipolar disorder that was discovered later, and also brain damage. Defect directly affecting his judgment, his impulse control, and emotional regulation. Now, would that have saved him from the death penalty? We don't know. But it was not even presented. Now, something, a matter like this might very well raise an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. But that issue has to be raised. And the only way that an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel can be raised is it's got to be raised by a lawyer. Moreno Ramos couldn't do it himself. So as the law is structured, he proceeded with his post-conviction remedies. That is the jury finding of guilt and assessing the death penalty automatically is appealed to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And so the Court of Criminal Appeals, looking at the record, decided there's no reason to overturn this verdict and sentence.
Let me ask you a couple of questions here. First of all, did he have a lot of priors? Is there a record of him before this incident?
I didn't see much of anything about a record, Paige. Did you?
That was not revealed in the direct appeal to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and I haven't read anything about his priors. However, the allegations in punishment concerning the facts of the abuse of his elder son suggest that he could not have gone unscathed. We just don't know.
But from a procedural standpoint, he got all of the hoops were jumped through legally. That is, he got his direct appeal. He got a state habeas proceeding to see whether there was anything illegal that improperly went on the trial. And he was appointed a lawyer on the state habeas. Okay, then he had a federal habeas. Okay, and then going into the federal system. All the hoops were jumped through, and the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel was not raised at all. So when the Supreme Court denied a certiorari on the very last stage of his appeals, an international case was found that as a Mexican national, he has there is a requirement that the Mexico has the right to be consulted and determined whether they want to get involved in the case or not. So that case resulted in a further post-conviction effort to be being made on Mr. Ramos's part. Did you have something to say about that, Paige?
Well, the issues became much more complicated as the result of a case that was found in 2007. And in 2007, the Supreme Court said that we need to go ahead and have the consular officials notified. But then, as that turned in the appellate system, it was found that the president, who had attempted to guarantee that the consular officials would be notified, didn't have the power to do that. And
I'm sorry, the Mexican president or the United States?
The United States president.
Okay.
Would have been George Bush at the time.
Okay. Yes. And it was found by the appellate courts that because the state of Texas provides the appeal, that the federal authorities do not have the right to interfere, ultimately do not have the right to interfere in the Texas process of appeals, or in the Arkansas process of appeals, or the Florida process of appeals. And thus, all of the regulations and the opinions issued by the United States government in reference to, it's the AEDPA?
Avino case.
In reference to the Avino case, were discounted by the United States Supreme Court and said, thank you, but no. Here is our procedure and here is what we will do.
And the Avina case was a case out of the International Court of Justice. So we have an international court saying that we need to review these things. And we have a president saying the cases need to be, the cases of Mexican nationals need to be reviewed. Well, Texas decided to, okay, fine, let's grant them the possibility of a subsequent appeal. But the subsequent appeal was for a very limited purpose. And that is violation of international law.
All right, let me stop you right there, and we'll get back to this in just a moment. For those of you who are waiting anxiously to hear about Arab Voices, it will return next week in its regularly scheduled time from 6 to 7 p.m. At the moment, you are listening to Execution Watch, the only online electronic vigil. Whenever the state of Texas plans an execution, this show will be on the air on KPFT 90.1 FM and broadcast, of course, at www.kpft.org for all of our international visitors. I'd like to remind you that there are vigils going on all over the place. Not only are there vigils in front of the Huntsville Death House, there are also vigils here in the city of Houston. You can find one looking through some of the organizations that support the abolishment of the death penalty. Please, if you have time, join them. If you don't know anything about the death penalty, if you are concerned about what capital punishment is in the state of Texas, you're always welcome to go to Execution Watch, either on our social media or, of course, at executionwatch.org. I'm here in the studio at 419 Lovett Boulevard with our experts, Larry Douglas and Paige Yannick. We are waiting for the final word from our reporter in front of the death house, Linda Hujan. Let's get back to our discussion with Larry Douglas and Paige Yannick.
I'm encouraged, Marlo, by the fact that we haven't gotten word yet. It leaves, gives us hope, right? That we haven't had a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. That this gives us some hope that perhaps he may eventually have his time to present the ineffective assistance of counsel argument. Now, ineffective assistance of counsel doesn't mean it's just your lawyers did a bad job. Okay, I have never tried a case or given a speech or even gone into a negotiation session where you don't make some mistakes. Okay, you're just always, or you wish you'd said something different. But a litigant has to show that his lawyer's performance was substantially subpar, that he did just a terrible job. And not only was this the performance substantially subpar, but it actually undermines the legal process, saying that the difference was critical. It would have, not necessarily would it have made a difference, but a critical difference. In this case, once the appellate process was proceeding and the mitigation issues were fully investigated, and seeking to present them. Moreno Ramos's lawyer, his first lawyer on appeal, on his first habeas effort, that was his very first time ever handling post-conviction remedies for on a death row case. He admitted, "I just really didn't know what I was doing," in so many words. He signed an affidavit saying, "This is my first time doing this," missed several deadlines and so forth, and just failed to do a full, he himself had failed to completely investigate mitigation. And so as a result, he says, you know, he might have had a chance at presenting the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel at that time. He failed to do it. Writes an affidavit saying, "I failed." But by this time, Mr. Moreno Ramos had already had his first federal writ. And the courts are really protective of coming back and filing another writ. Their position was, "You had your chance. We're not going to hear it." And so no matter what the mitigation evidence might have been that could have been presented at trial, it's not going to come in. Now, when the International Court of Justice caused the proceeding to be opened back up, the state of Texas said that we don't have to. We'll look at this. We'll look to see if there was if there was some error made in failure to notify the Mexican consulate, and having the Mexican consulate come into the case. They said, "We'll open this back up." So they allowed him a subsequent writ for the purpose of investigating the failure to notify the Mexican consulate. Mexican consulate comes forward and says, "We would have gotten involved." Now, once he filed his subsequent writ, that was allowed. His lawyer then seeks to amend the writ application by including an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
And it was so far down the appellate path that the judges, although they would consider it, they said, "Yes, we're considering it to the extent of denying you the right to prosecute ineffective assistance of counsel on appeal."
Exactly.
That time is all done.
So the consideration was saying that this really amounts to a subsequent writ, and we're not going to allow a subsequent writ, even though now there was his arguments were that while if this is in the form of a subsequent writ, this issue has never been adjudicated. All I want to do is have the issue adjudicated. And even the flurry of filings that were made today to the court that may have resulted in if nothing more than a delay, those subsequent filings, Moreno Ramos was very clear. So I'm not trying to overturn the finding of guilt. But would you just look at my evidence of ineffective assistance of counsel? Let me show you that there is mitigation evidence. And if that mitigation evidence comes in, then there is a possibility that the death penalty may be deemed to be inappropriate in this case. Now, what harm is it going to do to send him to prison for the rest of his life? You know, how the future danger notwithstanding, the mitigation is there some reason why we should not put this man to death? And that's what he's trying to do.
The time is now 18:30. half past 6 o'clock, of course, and you are listening to Execution Watch here at 90.1 FM in Houston. If you are expecting to hear our voices, please check back with us next week in this time slot, where you will, of course, hear your favorite show. We are waiting here with our legal experts, Larry Douglas and Paige Yannick, waiting to hear if the witnesses have actually crossed over to the death house. We do have eyes and ears on Huntsville. Thank you very much, Mike Lewis and the Prison Show, for giving us that opportunity. This is something, of course, you can also do if you follow Mike Lewis. Please go ahead and check his Facebook feed. You can see what's actually going on right there in front of the death house. My name is Marlo Blue. I'm here in lieu of the host, Ray Hill. Thank you for joining us. You can always get more information from Execution Watch at executionwatch.org and on our social media page at Execution Watch. While we await to hear from Linda Houhan or the Supreme Court, we'll come back to our conversation with Larry and Paige.
Also, Marlo, if you look back in the early 1990s, we didn't do a whole lot to qualify lawyers for specific cases. You have a bar license, you go down, you sign up, and you can take appointments on any kind of case from a Class B misdemeanor to a capital murder. If the judge wants to appoint you on a capital murder, judge could. Didn't have to prove any kind of qualification. We've since remedied that problem to a great extent. But unfortunately, there are certain people who, in the past, fell through the cracks. And chances are, if he were not a Mexican national, Miranda Ramos, you know, would have already been executed. Because back then, you know, there were guys who would come out of law school and head straight down to the courthouse. Once you get your bar license, got a brand new bar card, if you were close to the judge, I need you to appoint me on a capital. Yeah, I'll take it.
I understand the incompetency that we're dealing with, but I have to ask, wasn't this in front of a jury? Wasn't this a jury trial?
Yes, it was a jury trial. But the standards of appointment qualification have changed dramatically throughout the state over the past 25 years. Here in Harris County, we started seriously qualifying capital cases in, I believe, 1994.
And I'm not sure exactly when it happened. Yes. Being qualified for all levels of offenses, absolutely.
But this is Hidalgo County, and their population is significantly less than Harris County. And thus, the pool of lawyers from which they might draw was significantly diminished. That doesn't excuse poor performance, but there is not enough of an appellate record to prove poor performance. Other than the absence of the appellate record itself, there's not a lot of direct evidence on appeal about the performance of the lawyer in this trial.
Well, the post conviction, the writ lawyers, if the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel is going to be raised, it's going to be raised at the writ level.
Right.
But when you look at the record, and I haven't seen the record, but it's my understanding that trial counsel, you mentioned, Marlo, that this was before jury. Juries can only decide based on what they hear. And what they heard, it appears, was fairly one-sided. I saw something that says that the trial counsel never even asked the jury to consider life, something other than death, never even made the request.
And at that time, the maximum sentence for parole eligibility on a life sentence was 35 years. Now we have, you know, life without parole. But at that time in Texas, having served 35 years, I believe Mr. Ramos would have been 73 years old prior to receiving parole eligibility on this offense.
But
what was his actual legal status here in the States?
None.
I think he was here illegally. But even clearly he's a citizen of Mexico, and that entitles him to have, but entitles the right is for the Mexican government, the Mexican consulate, to be notified and then make the determination as to whether they want to get involved at all. But in this case, when you consider that the trial counsel, never investigated, the whole issue of mitigation, never got a mitigation expert, never, and even the habeas counsel, in his, affidavit that he submitted as part of the appeal, admitted that he did not have the training, experience, or assistance, or resources, or time to do what he felt was necessary, that he was over his head. And he admitted to that. Now you can't overestimate the value of having time and resources that the state certainly always has.
Mm-hmm.
They have investigators on staff who go out and do the full investigation. The habeas lawyer says, look, I was a solo practitioner. You know, I took this case on. I had never done a writ like this. I'd never done a capital writ before. This is my first time. Never saw it, but never secured an investigator. Just go to the court and ask for an investigation. I never did that. I never asked for an expert. Never did that. I never conducted any kind of investigation on my own. Never tried to do anything that would support the whole issue of mitigation, which is the sole issue that the defense lawyer is required to do, that the writ lawyer would have been required to do as part of his job. He says, I didn't know what to do. He had missed several deadlines because I just didn't know.
Right.
Okay. So he pretty much to his credit, pretty much just fell on the sword and said, I failed this man.
Right.
And now, Moreno Ramos is saying, well, his failure should not lead to my death. I can't do this myself. I depend on a lawyer to do this. And if the lawyer says I didn't do a good job in perfecting the client's rights, then should the client suffer for that?
Correct. Well, you are listening to Execution Watch. The time right now is 6:38. You are listening to 90.1 FM, a very special edition of Execution Watch. While we are still waiting to hear if the witnesses have actually crossed over to witness the execution, we do have eyes and ears on going on in Huntsville, and we will let you know as soon as that happens. So the timing of what is happening right now, if you're new to the death penalty, if you're wanting to know what is going on, well, of course, Robert Moreno Ramos is strapped to a gurney. He is waiting to find out the same things as we are. They are waiting to find out if the Supreme Court will step in and to see if this particular execution will proceed. This is a slightly different case because he was a Mexican national. And 1 year ago, on November the 8th, 2017, Texas executed Mexican citizen Ruben Cardenas Ramirez. He was the last Mexican national that had been executed by the state of Texas. So this is nothing particularly new. The state of Texas is going to do what it wants to do. Is that correct?
The state of Texas is going to follow the law of the state of Texas. And if a jury decides that execution is the punishment on a capital murder, the state of Texas will execute the defendant if it is not overturned on direct appeal or on habeas proceedings.
And I spoke earlier about the discretion that the prosecutors have in seeking the death penalty. The courts have a great deal of discretion, too. The structure of the system, I was talking about habeas counsel and his apparent failures that he admitted to. Another concern is just straight up economics. Back then, there was a cap for habeas counsel, post-conviction counsel. You get appointed to the case, $7,500. No such cap on the prosecutor's office. And the $7,500, this is like if you pay them $7,500, you're going to get $7,500 worth of work. Okay, that's what you're going to get. It was so bad that a former Court of Criminal Appeals judge, Charles Baird, says, you know, if you do this kind of stuff, you're going to end up appointing some terrible lawyers. They're going to be terrible because if that's what you're paying them, that's what you're going to get. And even if he is a great lawyer, you don't have the time to do all the things that need to be done. Now, that $7,500 ceiling, so the judges, you know, and we have some what we call now presumptive maximums. Yes. The judges will let you go through, but you've got to go through the hassle of going back to the judge and begging for some more money. There are many states in the U.S. One of the articles mentioned to me that have special counsel for handling death penalty cases, so that you have the expert lawyers in there doing so. This case, while it raises a lot of interesting points. One of the most interesting points I think it raises is that, you know, what are we as what you mentioned, Marlo, what's the state of Texas going to do? Is the state of Texas going to look at itself and determine, you know, what are we doing here in terms of making sure that before we execute a person, that we at least give him an opportunity to exercise, to bring up his own defenses and not allow procedural bars to be so insurmountable that we need to do a little bit more to say this is a case that probably begs for somebody to at least consider mitigation. If mitigation is so important, and it is, then it ought to be considered. And even at this stage, I think he's probably made a strong enough argument to be heard. And one of the Court of Criminal Appeals judges, Judge Alcala, said that, you know, she dissented and said, you know, we need to hear this, man. We really need to hear. It might not make any difference at all. We might end up at the same place. But I would certainly feel more comfortable as a lawyer and as a Texan that if we were to allow someone to take a look and to seriously consider, was this sufficient mitigation? Can we provide enough mitigation to decide, should we or should we not put this man to death?
All right, Larry. Well, thank you for this. We're going to come back to this in just a moment. But at the moment, I would like to bring in someone who is joining us now live in the studio. Is Amy Morales. And she's currently administrating as the end-of-life doula for Ray Hill, our activist, founder, and host of Execution Watch. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marlo. Happy to be here.
Well, first of all, could you give us an update on Ray Hill's condition?
Certainly. Ray is stable within his unstable condition. Ray is much like he lived. He is dying in that same way, his unique own way.
Going to the River Styx.
That's it. In his own time. None of us can call it. So.
Explain to us a little bit about what you actually do. What does a doula do?
So if you go back to the origin of the word doula, it's the most revered servant that a household has. And many people are doulas and they don't even realize it. Mm. Lay people who take care of their family members who are getting ready to leave this earth. Medical professionals, nurses and doctors who are helping people prepare for death. They doula. A doula provides non-medical help and resources to the dying person and their family. Those things can be emotional, spiritual, physical. I'm there to help Ray along this journey. Tie up loose ends,
And I can imagine that's quite a monumental task. I've seen some of the things that he's dictated to you, which is thrilling for us to keep hearing the words of Ray Hill, but it must be incredibly burdensome to get all that down. Is this what you always wanted to do?
First, it's anything but a burden.
Excellent.
I love it. It is not what I always wanted to do. I never even knew that this existed. It wasn't until my estranged ex-husband was murdered in 2009 that I started to have this preoccupation with death. And then I started working at an oncology practice and noticing that dozens of young people were dying of cancer. And I helped one young lady, and on her deathbed, she told me, "I think you're supposed to be a hospice nurse." And I said, "I think you're right." So then I started doing hospice, and I've been doing that, and I found this calling. I found an article in the New York Times that talked about a death doula, and there are people in different parts of our country who are making this their profession. And I thought, that's me. That's what I do. So I'm trying to spearhead the movement down here in Houston. There's a little resistance because people say, well, isn't that what a nurse does? Isn't that what a social worker does?
But it's a growing field, isn't it?
It's a growing field, and we do so much. The nurse and the social worker, they're invaluable because they do such a great job, but they cannot sit down and talk to you about your funeral, about exactly what you want. They can't take direct orders. You know, they work for an entity, for a company. And as an individual, I'm hoping to start my own practice to do this and to assist people to die the way that they want to die.
What is the most commonly asked question that you get?
Isn't that horribly sad? Isn't that sad what you do all day? And my answer is no, it's not. We prepare for the birth of every new baby, right? We put much thought into it. We pour a lot of money into it. Do we do that for death? Not really. People don't want to talk about it. They act like it's not going to happen, but it is just as great as an event as being born. And we should prepare for it as such.
And would you behave differently for someone who is being executed versus someone who is dying of natural causes?
I would not. I am so honored to be here because to me, death is death is death. And it's something that I'm intrigued by, and it makes no difference to me what the means, what, you know, how you're dying. I would like to bring peace and comfort to every soul that I get to cross paths with who's dying. And it doesn't matter if it's a disease, if it's execution. I just want to hold the hands, if I can, or metaphorically speaking, of those who are encountering their own demise.
How important is the healing power of touch to someone who's dying?
I wish that you could ask Ray Hill right now and he could answer that.
I wish I could too.
Because it is something you almost can't explain. Sometimes he's really having a rough day and I just rub his hands or I just scratch his head and you can just hear him just sighing. It's so important. And Ray has a lot of people to touch him and to love him, but think about the people who don't and think about these guys.
Think about
on
Robert
death
Moreno
row.
Ramos sitting there
all alone,
never been touched, but who has not been touched by a family member since his actual sentencing.
No human touch. He's still a human.
Yeah.
Whatever he's accused of doing, whatever he did, humans are still humans. And I've taken care of a lot of people on their deathbeds, and it doesn't matter to me what they did in life. I'm here to help the dying.
Amy, how do people contact you if they have questions regarding your services or if they're in need of services such as you provide?
So my website's currently being built. So in the interim, you can reach me. My email is dyingdifferently@gmail. On Facebook, it's Houston Death Doula. And on Instagram, it's Death Doula Houston. And doula is spelled D-O-U-L-A.
D-O-U-L-A.
We need snail mail.
I'm sorry, do you have an actual physical address where it's, we're not supposed to give out websites?
Oh, so sorry. I do not have a physical address at this point.
Can they contact you here at the station?
Absolutely, you can contact me here at the station.
So that would be 419 Lovett Boulevard, care of Execution Watch, Houston, Texas, 77006. Again, that's 419 Lovett Boulevard, Amy Morales, care of Execution Watch, that's Houston, Texas, 77006. Amy, thank you, and thank you for what you're doing with Ray. Ray, if you're listening, come on back, man. We love you. We absolutely love you. The time is now 6:51. You are listening to Execution Watch here on KPFT 90.1 FM. If you are expecting to hear air voices, please, please check back next week, and we will be happy to have that information come through. The show will be back on next week. We're going to try and contact our reporter in front of the death house right now, Linda Hujan. Of course, we have been looking at some of the video that's been feeding from social media. We have been trying to find out more information. It really doesn't appear that the witnesses have actually crossed, but there's so few witnesses, it's a little bit hard to tell. And we are still trying to get information from the Supreme Court to see if there is a stay, if there is some news for Robert Moreno Oremos. Joining me here in the studio is Larry Douglas and Paige Yannick. As we try and contact Linda, let's just go on and go a little bit further. Of course, there's been some horrific shootings, some mass murders, some horrible things that have brought the idea of the death penalty back into the spotlight again in a different viewpoint from, I believe, what we see here in Houston. Do you all have any thoughts on this?
I wouldn't even conceive of how to talk to Californians about... I wouldn't even know how to conceive of talking to Californians about a mass murder and how they ought to be handling it. I think that the legislatures of each state attempt to go ahead and consider the electorate and fashion laws in consideration of the populace. But I have no idea how to talk to people who have been victims of mass murders. I just don't.
It's a very strange feeling. I understand that completely. Before I get your thoughts on that, Larry, let me go back first to our reporter from in front of the death house, Linda Hujan. Linda. Hello, Linda. We'll try and get her back on the line. As we know so far, the actual witnesses have not crossed over. That gives us a little bit of hope that perhaps this execution will not take place at this time in our particular time slot. You are listening to Execution Watch. We're about to wrap it up here. And make way for the next show. Please, if you're listening for Arab Voices, they will come back on next week. Larry, any closing thoughts?
Well, I just got an update from Elizabeth Stein,
okay,
saying that she just received an email from the Supreme Court. The state's memorandum in opposition to Mr. Moreno Ramos's efforts to stop the execution. So the matters in the court still continue. I consider that promising.
So, for the moment, the execution is not scheduled to happen.
Correct.
No. Well, the execution is scheduled to happen, but it's at a legal impasse, which will preclude it from happening until the Supreme Court rules one way or the other.
Exactly.
And under Texas law, if we execute someone, we must do it prior to midnight. Isn't that correct, Larry?
59, yeah.
It has to be completed by that time, and I think Ray's mentioned that in order for it to be completed by that time, then it's got to be begun. You ever had to begin it by a certain time.
All right, let's go to Linda.
Yes.
we just heard, of course, that SCOTUS has come down and said that they're at a legal impasse for now. Can you tell us what's happening there in front of the death house?
Nothing. We're all just standing around waiting, I mean, because there's nothing happening right now.
And have they already gotten word about what the Supreme Court has said?
No, nothing.
Larry, would you like to tell her?
Well, as of right now, the Supreme Court is still considering the state's memorandum. No decision has been made as of yet in terms of whether the court's going to allow the execution to proceed or not.
Okay.
So you can share that with Mike and those of you who are standing outside of the death house.
Okay.
Linda,
I sure will.
Thank you very much for your observations. I'm sorry that we have to come to you only in times of executions, but thank you for being there, and thank you for your vigil.
All right, thank you very much.
And we're about to wrap it up here at Execution Watch for the final moment. On behalf of myself and Ray Hill, I certainly want to thank our legal experts, Larry Douglas, Paige Yannick, our producer, of course, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for that. Ray Hill, we will never, ever be able to thank you enough for all that you do for so many, many people. And thanks to our panel. Thanks to Elizabeth Stein. On behalf of your regular host, Ray Hill, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.